the film Female Trouble, the drag queen Divine screamed, "Who wants to die for art?" Nowadays, the answer would be, "We all do, but first, let's take a selfie." By breaking all the rules, Divine ushered in the concept of the modern drag queen built on rebellion. Drag used to focus on female impersonation, but Divine took it in a whole new direction that's still being celebrated.
Sadly, 30 years ago today, Glenn Harris Milstead, a.k.a. Divine, passed away just as he was about to film her breakthrough television role on Married with Children. Today, Peaches Christ joins us to take a look at the life and legacy of America's first drag superstar, Divine, and why drag queens who came of age at the time of RuPaul and Lady Bunny were more interested in being rebels than passing as beautiful women.
Plus, Peaches Christ talks about her sister, Bendela Christ's controversial move on Drag Race All-Stars 3.
And her upcoming show in Chicago with her gal pal, Mink Stole, Idol Worship, coming to Hamburger Mary's in Chicago on April 18th. Don't miss it.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Peaches Christ is coming to town. Lock up your daughters and your sons.
She's coming with her gal pal, Mink Stole, to perform their cabaret show, Idol Worship, where they chat about Mink's illustrious career working with John Waters.
Grab your tickets at peacheschrist.com.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Is this pig fucker?
Who's calling here?
Pussy Willow.
I've called the police and they're tracing this number right now.
Yay. It's the 30-year anniversary of the death of the filthiest person alive, Divine.
Yes, my God, she died 30 years ago.
It's hard to believe it's been that long, huh?
On this very day.
Yeah.
She was scheduled to film a guest appearance on Married with Children.
As Uncle Otto. And it was supposed to be a recurring role, too, wasn't it, or something? It was a guest appearance?
It was supposed to be her breakout moment into mainstream.
Right. Yeah, I guess it was a huge deal. I mean, it still kind of is. You know, I think it's funny because we're doing Drag Becomes Her this weekend, and Heclina's playing the part of Ernest. Mm-hmm. And people are really hung up on that. Like, when I run into them in the street, or like, you know, I did this interview for the show, and the interviewer kept saying, like, why is Heclina playing a man? You know, and it's like so interesting that, well, as we're talking about these days, like, that people still have this concept that there are rules for drag queens. And I think for Divine, you know, it was a big deal for her that she was going to play a man on a national TV show. But she'd actually played a man, you know, in multiple John Waters movies. People just didn't, you know, pay attention, I guess.
Yeah, they didn't see it, I guess, in some sense. Like, when you look at Female Troubles, like, she fucks herself in it.
She literally fucks herself.
And that's probably got to be one of my favorite
scenes. She plays a male character, and through the magic of editing, they show her having sex with herself.
Yeah, he picks her up hitchhiking, right? And then they fuck in the woods. And then in Hairspray, he was Edna Turnblatt, and then he was also the
amusement park owner who didn't want to integrate.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, in Female Trouble, I mean, Earl Peterson, that's his name. It's just so, I'm sorry, but that is so brilliant and still so ahead of its time to have a character fuck herself, whatever. It's just still so creative and inspiring.
Yeah, it was totally done so well. But, you know, for Divine, too, it was like a part of his career was he enjoyed doing the drag stuff, but he liked to think of himself as an actor and really kind of, he really wanted to get those roles as a dude.
Yeah, I think so. He often described himself as an actor first, you know, and drag was just one of the tools of his, you know, acting. Mm. But he also was a big drag queen, you know, he was both things, you know.
Well, Divine loved to style, was a hairstylist and work, and his mother in the documentary I Am Divine brags about how she was the star because her son knew how to style and do hair and makeup.
Right, exactly.
For many drag queens today, RuPaul's Drag Race undoubtedly has inspired them to go down this cross-dressing, anarchistic showbiz path. But for queens like you and me, who came of age before RuPaul really launched herself into the national scene, it was John Waters films and Divine that inspired our generation of drag queens to be radicals.
For sure. I mean, John Waters, you know, I've said it a million times on your show, but it bears repeating. It was, you know, John Waters and Divine and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. That was really my introduction to the world of drag. And so I saw it through this sort of chaotic punk rock, insane lens. You know, that was my introduction.
What would have been the faux pas? Because drag queens today are all obsessed about how contoured their makeup is, right? But back then, the faux pas was to not be outrageous. To pee or not to pee, that was the question. Shall I also eat dog poop too?
And to be an individual, which I think makeup-wise is the biggest change I've seen with the internet and the TV show and all of this, where back then, our makeup skills were terrible. We, you know, were faking it. We didn't have access to tutorials and products and this and that. But part of it was, a big part of it was individuality and using makeup that you could access from wherever, fucking Walgreens or whatever, to make your face as unique as possible. And now I don't want to sound like one of those bitter old queens, you know, but the youngins today, to me, I'm like literally looking at them and going like, is that so-and-so? You know, is that, you know, and even...
Is that Balenciaga, MAC, Jeffree Star, Sugar Pill? This lipstick is by Astro Girl, and this one is by Magic Mountain. And
over things, like, people learn, and over time, people improve on things. Because if you look at the Olympics that started like in the late 1800s, the people that won those Olympic medals back then wouldn't even qualify to be in the Olympics now, because people have just kind of, you know, you learn, and people that were before you, they challenge you. And you keep on improving.
Whereas it's true. David Lockery and Mary Vivian Pierce in Pink Flamingos, who dyed their hair bright blue and orange.
It was Mink Stoll.
Oh, it was Mink Stoll.
David Lockery. Mm-hmm. She dyed her hair red and he dyed his hair blue.
But they did it not by going to the store and buying the, you know, special effects or Manic Panic and dyeing their hair. They did it by bleaching their hair bright white and then getting magic markers and laying down on a table while their friends markered their hair those bright colors.
Yeah, they took out the big ink pads inside the magic markers, broke them open, and then had them that saturated magic marker ink just run through their hair repeatedly.
And you had to do that, like, if you wanted your hair that color, if you wanted streaks like that, you had to do that well into, like, the mid-'80s. Because I don't think Manic Panic didn't even come out until, like, late 80s.
I remember the first time I dressed up with a bright blue wig. Yeah. And all the drag queens in town looked at me like I was insane. And they were like, that's such an ugly color.
Yeah. And it's really important to remember. And they're not as quick to acknowledge this as they should be. And I'm talking about John and Mink and the Dreamlanders, the original troupe. They were called the Dreamlanders in Baltimore. When they did that for Pink Flamingos, it hadn't been done before. You know, there is no record. The punk rock scene or movement hadn't really gotten started in 1970, 71 when they were shooting that movie. They actually inspired a lot of the looks that we now, that are now synonymous with punk rock. The early 1970s, no one was dyeing their hair primary colors.
And early punk rock was working class, blue collar kind of looks. And then it eventually developed into like, hey, let's add some flair to this, and the colored hair and the mohawks. And you're saying that because they in those movies that they dyed their hair that color, that translated into, you know, the alternative people wanting to do that.
I think so. so. I mean, I feel like it really influenced a lot. Like, that movie and its effect wasn't limited to changing the drag scene, which it did, clearly. I mean, my God. But also a lot of scenes in fashion and culture. You know, and a lot of fashion designers have said that they have knocked off, you know, Van Smith's brilliant designs for Divine over the years, you know, pretty blatantly.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that John Waters says? Take your worst feature and accentuate it.
I think that's James St. James.
Or was it James? Well, James St. James is quoting John Waters on that. He? Yeah. It was that if you have a, I think in God, what is it? Shock Treatment or one of his books? John Waters talks about the Wicked Witch of the West, who had this giant green hook nose, and the reason that you paid attention to her is because they painted bright green makeup on that nose and it made it pop out. And so in some ways, filmmakers like John Waters and performers like Divine were fascinated with the outrageous elements of filmmakers like Russ Meyers, who directed the classic Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill. Certainly, Tura Santana's performance in that film inspired Divine in the film Female Trouble. Or later on, Russ Meyers' films Beyond the Valley of the Dolls with Roger Ebert, or even the very sexual with Quentin Natividad Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens, Russ Meyers' films started becoming synonymous with pornography, but it was a very outrageous pornography. And so when I was watching television when Divine died in 1988, as a teenager, I would sit glued watching MTV and Night Tracks, and they announced that this drag queen had died, and she was a star of porn films. And I was like, and then they showed her image, and I was like, what porn is this? Where were you when Divine died? Or do you remember when you heard the first heard the news?
Yeah, because I was, so this was around the time that I was first really kind of introduced to Divine, was because growing up a kid in Maryland, I didn't know about these guys. Because I was young, I was a kid, and I went to a Catholic school, and so, you know, you're protected from that kind of thing. So, you know, I grew up, I mean, the most transgressive stuff I really had access to was, you know, at the video store, and mostly it was horror movies, you know, weird, trashy horror movies. And so I didn't know about John Waters or Divine until they released Hairspray. And in Maryland, that was a big deal. It kind of was, well, it wasn't kind of, it was their crossover movie. It was where Maryland finally became proud of these freaks, and everyone was so excited because here was this, like, you know, wonderful, critically lauded movie about racial integration in Baltimore, and it was quirky and weird. And for me, I had to kind of downplay my fascination with this actor who was playing the mother because, you know, I didn't want everyone to know I was a big old wannabe drag queen. And I was 12 or 13 or whatever. And so when she passed away, it was big local news. It was a big deal, you know? And I just remember having to kind of almost sort of silently mourn, you know, I remember that feeling of being sad for something, but not wanting to let people know, you know, how sad I was. But because it was Hairspray that led me to kind of discover Pink Flamingos and go to Mom's Video on Kent Island, you know, in the Chesapeake Bay, and rent things like, you know, not just Pink Flamingos, but also like Caligula and other things that kids should not.
That was pretty much the dirtiest thing you could rent at a regular video store.
Well, were you shocked when you first saw the chicken? I think there's a scene where a guy's butthole is lip syncing.
Yeah.
And somebody has sex with a chicken and cuts their head off. I mean, you know, Pink Flamingos is a very radical film.
Yes, and it's shot in color. Shocks people. Yeah.
Even to this day, and certainly the end of that film, Divine eating that dog shit, it weighed on her. It haunted her for the rest of her life.
Well, it worked exactly the way they hoped it would, but no one had considered, you know, the sort of the ramifications of becoming famous for some, you know, an act like that. And yeah, I think it did. It was sort of like she was always known as a shit eater, you know, and would be for the rest of her life. What's ironic to me watching it today, and especially when I've screened it for students or young people, the shit eating is actually one of the less shocking things as far as, you know, people's triggers go and stuff, you know, in the movie. So it's funny because back then that was really the thing that shocked people the most. Now, you know, watching a guy grab a chicken and stick it between him and another woman while he humps the woman and the chicken's head is kind of accidentally detached from its body, you know, and the chicken blood is kind of, you know, running all over them. Like that scene or the singing asshole or the concept of kidnapping women and having a butler, you know, impregnate them so that these kidnapped women can give birth to babies that are sold to lesbians. You know, those ideas really, really upset young people, you know. But back then, none of that was as upsetting as Divine actually eating shit. It's hilarious because that's not as upsetting because these kids grew up with, you know, Fear Factor and, you know, fucking Dragula or whatever. But those other concepts that are really quite cruel and vicious and, you know, the young people have a much harder time with that. So it's interesting. It's still very, very shocking to people, just maybe in a different way.
Things have changed. Like you see a movie nowadays and if there's an animal in it, at the end of the movie, they'll be like, no animals were harmed in the making of this film, you know.
Right. In this case.
But not in this case.
You know, they ate that chicken for dinner.
Did they really?
Apparently, that's what they say. I mean, they didn't have craft services, you know, whatever. So they like they, you know, defeathered it and cooked it up.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, notoriously, they were all, you know, high on pot and it was they were out shooting those scenes in the middle of the woods and they were, you know, like starving. You know, Mink, you know, talks about how there was no food on the set. You know, they were poor.
It was cold. And they were high.
It was cold. They were high. And they were doing things that no movie set, you know, no professional movie set would allow. You know, if you watch when Mink Stole is lighting a torch to burn down Divine's trailer, she has no fire training. They doused that thing in gasoline. You can see she's completely freaked out when it goes up in flames. And she's yelling, fire, fire, burn it down. And trying to get the thing away from her. Fire, fire, to the ground. She swings it back and her fucking coat catches on fire. And then she tosses the thing into the trailer as she's trying to beat the fire off her coat.
Nonchalantly.
This is, you know, and where she drew the line was when John said, you know, in this scene, I'd like you to set your hair on fire. And she said, I'm not setting my hair on fire.
Wow.
And you know. You're become friends with a lot of these extraordinary people. I think John Waters gives you the keys to his apartment in Provincetown.
I do not have the keys to his apartment at all. However, I have been asked to, you know, run errands and do things where there's a certain amount of trust given to me as far as, you know, our friendship goes, but I do not have keys to his apartment here or anywhere else.
Does he send you to develop film for him?
No, I mean, you know, it's like, and you know, what's funny now is I don't
go to the sex shop, buy me the biggest dildo.
I'm often not their go-to person for help in San Francisco anymore because of my kooky travel schedule. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm often not here, you know, he has a place here and the last few times that he's been here, I've been away, you know, so it's been kind of a bummer, but we see each other a lot in Provincetown.
Let's talk about your show, Idol Worship. You're coming to Chicago on April the 18th to perform with Mink Stole at Hamburger Mary's.
I am so excited about that and have to thank you guys so much for helping to make that all happen.
You're welcome.
And you know, help arrange it with the venue. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Mink and I, we did this show last year in Provincetown and then decided, well, let's take it out on the road. And anyone who wants to book it or bring us to a city can reach out to me. And Mink and I have a, you know, a packaged little cabaret show where we talk, we do like a chat show, but we also sing songs and we show movie clips. And, you know, it ended up being such a fun night in Provincetown that we, you know, if you're a Mink Stole fan, I can pretty much guarantee you're going to enjoy this show. We're a fan of John Waters, and especially the early films of John. You know, we really dive in and you get to hear, you know.
What if we like Max Doyle, but we hate you? Will we still enjoy it?
Yes.
I'm just kidding. Listen, folks, go to peacheschrist.com, go to her store, get your ticket today, because it's nearly sold out and it's a month away. So it's going to be rough. So if you didn't buy a ticket already, it might be too late. But, you know, it's still go.
I want to say on behalf of the people who are going to be dragging their feet to this, don't ask us to sneak you in because we cannot do that. And it's going to break my heart. Mm-hmm. If you want to go see this show, reach out to us now. We will need a couple of volunteers to help set up chairs that day.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind manual labor,
email me.
Part of the charm of this show is that we are intentionally doing it in small venues, mm-hmm. in a cabaret space. Mm-hmm. So the tickets have been selling well, you know, in most of the markets. And I think we're not going to probably add shows. You know, Mink and I are doing this because we want it to be intimate. And, you know, you're it's like sitting in our living room and we put on a little show for you in mm-hmm. the different places. And just if I can, I'd love to say that we're also going to Pittsburgh and Jacksonville, Florida.
Mm-hmm. This show's got legs because it's just you and Mink Stoll, and it's the charm of your friendship and your relationship to this amazing legacy.
I hope that's, yeah, I mean, I feel like that's part of what makes it kind of magical is sort of we are truly friends, and so this conversation can kind of go places that I don't script the questions. I know kind of a general flow of what topics I'd like to bring up, mm-hmm. but every show is different. You know, this isn't a scripted show. It's spontaneous. And of course we're going to bring, you know, some stories she's going to retell because they're stories that are really interesting that people want to hear. But, you know, there was stuff in Provincetown that was very specific to Provincetown that we won't probably touch on in Chicago. And there'll mm-hmm. be stuff in Chicago that we may not bring to Pittsburgh or whatever.
Does it get difficult to sit and listen to Mink Stoll say the same story over and over and over and over?
Not for me. I mean, that's one of the things that I feel like is truly one of the best parts of my job is that becoming friends with my idols, and we've talked about this before, I am such a true, humble fan when it comes to those friendships that when she talks about something like John asking her to light her hair on fire, I could hear that story 1,000 times and still be fascinated by it, you know, because I wasn't there and these movies changed my life. And so getting her to tell firsthand accounts of what it was like working with Edith Massey and Divine and what she and John created together, it's, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but we're doing the show in Chicago. And then a few days later, we do it in Pittsburgh. And then I'm actually going with Mink to Detroit. It's kind of a surprise, but whatever. I guess I'm ruining it for your Detroit listeners. But I'm going to be in Detroit for John's big birthday party. That's like this huge, massive weekend celebration. L7, the band is there. John is going to, you know, obviously be there. Like they're having a brunch with John and Mink, and I get to like basically be, you know, their date or whatever for the weekend. And so I'll be a surprise guest at Mink's concert in Detroit.
Where were you when they had the Hairspray premiere in Baltimore? Like you must have been in middle school at the time.
Yeah, I was in junior high, and those were the worst years of my life. Like, quite frankly, they still, you know, like Welcome to the Dollhouse really resonates with me. Mm. Like, I feel like those are hard, hard years, you know, the puberty years. And especially if you're a little sissy, a little gay boy, it's when kids who were formerly nice to you learn how to be mean. You know, I was just really, really aware of what a fucking weirdo I was. And so, you know, Hairspray.
Yeah. No crossover between being a kid and being a man is like, it's rough.
Yeah, I mean, like, I had no idea that, like, as a kid, every single thing I liked was queer or female. You know, like, luckily my parents didn't shame me, you know, around that stuff. But it was seventh and eighth grade where I learned real quick in Catholic school that I was a major faggot who was, you know, back then, like, they were, you know, would say things like, you're going to die of AIDS, you know, all that stuff, you know. There was a very cruel time, mm-hmm. you know, to be a young sissy. And I don't necessarily think it's easier today. I don't know. I'm not a kid. I hope it's mm-hmm. easier because yeah. of all the progress we've enjoyed. But I know for me, it was a miserable time. And also too, gayness and gay visibility was pretty much centered around death at the time, you know, AIDS activists and the queer community was experiencing, you know, a terrible epidemic. You know, just horrible proportions. So as a young person, that's all I was absorbing. Mm-hmm. So Hairspray was a fucking light at the end of the tunnel for me. It was salvation. I mean, I'm serious when I say Hairspray and the Rocky Horror Picture Show changed my life.
I think the reason why so many of us love Divine is because she had a passion. She looked like she was having a lot of fun.
Yes.
Being a rebel. You know, she was a rebel just for kicks. And John Waters talks about how drag queens at the time were really terrified yes. of Divine. They wanted to be either to look like real women mm-hmm. or dress up as their mothers. And here comes this drag queen, punk drag queen with scars on her face, you know, literally with a gun shooting down her audience members, throwing fish and temper tantrums and doing a acrobatic act. And she wasn't a very particularly good singer, yet she would put out all these indie techno dancey songs like Jungle Jezebel, Native Love. And John Waters said that when he heard her sing the first time, he said, "Take the money and run, honey."
Well, I mean, I actually like her music a lot. I wouldn't say that she has, you know, a great singing voice, but she certainly could entertain. And that disco, that bathhouse disco, is still so good. You know, if you listen to Shoot Your Shot or you think mm. you're a man or whatever, mm. it's great music. Totally mm. still can get people to get up and dance. Really good
one
stuff.
One of her last performances here while doing that live stuff was here at Chicago at the bathhouse here. It was Bistro too, but it was actually kind of part of the bathhouse. It was so I have a photo here I'm looking at. It says to Chuck, who's the guy who ran the bathhouse, "Love Divine." And it was, they fit, like, the room was supposed to fit, like, 1,300 people in it. They fit 2,500 people in it for Divine's last performance.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, don't you wonder, I mean, what life would be like if she hadn't passed? You know, like, what would be different, you know, about our culture and drag and, you know, it's just such an interesting thing to think of Divine. Mm-hmm. Maybe because I am buddies with John and Mink. It's just so, and they were friends, you know.
I think if Divine would have lived, I don't think she would have stayed in that type of intense situation as a drag queen. Divine wanted to be taken seriously as an actor. Look at him playing a gangster in the film Trouble in Mind. Mm-hmm. She already was moving into calmer, more nuanced, more sublime performances as
an
actor.
But you never know. She might have gotten more outrageous as you get more comfortable. Sometimes you're like, I need to push it further. And then, of course, like, would RuPaul even exist?
I think RuPaul is inevitable. But, mm-hmm. you know, for example, like, Divine was scheduled to record a song with Bronski Beat called Cha-Cha Heels. Mm. And after she died, they were like, what do we do? And Eartha Kitt was like, I'll take that song. give me Cha-Cha Heels. I want your Cha-Cha Heels.
Yeah.
And so it's so weird seeing Eartha Kitt singing this song that's obviously like written for Divine, mm. but it fits.
Yeah. I just think it's an interesting concept. And this friend of mine, his name is Leo Herrera. He's an artist and a filmmaker. He's done lots of photography for me over the years. He has this interesting film coming out called The Father's Project. Mm. And it's basically a vision of an alternate gay reality. And so what it explores is, what would our life be like today if AIDS hadn't happened? Mm. And It explores, like, what would Vito Russo be doing? What would Keith Haring be doing? It's just an interesting thing. And I know Divine didn't die of AIDS, but it's still interesting to think about these people who were so vital and around and could very well still be alive today, age-wise, you know, and how our world would be different if they hadn't passed.
Yeah, it's remarkable, you know, when I think about the damage that the plague's done to the society.
It shaped us. Yeah. It made the world a better place. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we've made significant improvements on our healthcare system because of the AIDS crisis. And even though we still have a tremendously backwards and outdated healthcare system, we've managed to eradicate a lot of new HIV infections. We have PrEP. We have amazing treatments today because of the sacrifices that a lot of these individuals did at a time period when they felt like they had nothing to lose. And you had, you know, these, you know, Divine and John Waters are two people who came from money in Baltimore. They lived in the same, just houses away from each other. And they could have just as easily been, you know, mainstream gays, you know, very, you know, having their gay sex on the side and having, you know, their life of privilege, but they threw that out the window for a life of adventure.
Yeah, it's true.
In so many ways, Peaches, your life and your artistic career mirrors theirs as well.
Well, I was completely inspired by them, and in so many ways. I mean, and you know, I met John when I was in college, and I was a film student, and I was basically telling him, like, I don't want to go home to Maryland. You know, I don't see what's there for me, and maybe I should move to New York, or maybe I should move to Los Angeles. And he was like, oh, have you ever thought about San Francisco? You know, me and Mink and Divine, we used to go out there. We used to perform with the Coquettes. And, you know, I was like, who the hell are the Coquettes? You know, because there was no documentary at the time. And he explained that they were this drag troupe of, you know, hippies who lived in a commune and performed shows before midnight movies. I mean, in many, many ways, John and Mink and Divine, they are like parents for me, you know, who kind of put me on a path. And now I've carved out my own version of a life or a career that involves kind of insanity and drag and creativity. I've made it, you know, done it my own way. And I really hope that, like, young people kind of continue to do that and have those sorts of role models and inspirations where it's like, follow your heart, choose an adventure, you know, fight for an exciting life. You know, we only have one as far as we know.
Divine was greeted by the Coquettes at the airport and everybody showed up in full drag. She got on the airplane in full drag, which is something like that really is hard to imagine in today's
in like security. 1970. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was for the movie Multiple Maniacs, which was made in 1969. Imagine that. Just imagine. They were so radical, so ahead of their time. I can't even imagine being at SFO in drag now. You know what I mean?
People would look, right? You see pictures from drag queens, like, I'm late for my gig, so I have to get ready at the airport.
Yeah, I mean, I was just in New Orleans for a few weeks and being in San Francisco, and I'm still surprised by the fact that we're in these major cities full of culture and drag and queerness, and you still get gawkers, you know? And don't even get me started about, you know, being on a celebrity cruise in the Caribbean and walking through the ship in full drag. Looks of horror, you know? Oh, and what are they going to do? They can't jump overboard. They're stuck there with us for 7 nights.
Take this drag, honey.
Well, your own drag makeup is very much a tribute, especially your eye makeup is a tribute to Divine.
Yes.
In female and Pink Flamingos.
Pink Flamingos, Female Trouble. I mean, you know, I didn't want to copy her makeup. I didn't want to do a Divine impersonation. And so I had read that she and John were very much inspired by Elizabeth Taylor, Tara Sultana, and Bozo the Clown. And so I kind of maybe went a little too far in the Bozo the Clown category. I don't know, but
certainly those arches on your over your eyes are a dead ringer for Bozo's eye makeup.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. I mean, that is exactly the photo I looked at. And back then, it was important to me that I not mimic Divine or impersonate Divine. Not that there's anything wrong with doing an impersonation or a mimic. It's just not what I was trying to do. Yeah. So I was looking at her inspirations, and I was looking at literally paintings of clowns when I created my my drag look. So when people call me a clown or call, like, you know, Bianca a clown, I'm like, yeah, I mean, that's literally what I did.
Divine was famously inspired by Liz Taylor. You can, like, it's hard for me nowadays to even watch some Liz Taylor movies because I think about Divine so much. Because, like, you really, when you watch Divine playing somebody, you're like, she's just being like Liz Taylor and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
And part of it is that she was attracted to that camp aesthetic. Yeah. And, you know, certainly, like, the films of Douglas Sirk also influenced John Waters and Divine tremendously. And there were big film enthusiasts. And I'm so glad that we live in a world that sometimes, like, the people that inspire us don't always get to see the benefits or the consequences of what they've done. And I can imagine that John Waters must get a lot of sense of pride in seeing your work and being friends with you, because in a lot of ways you're carrying on his legacy.
I hope, you know, it definitely makes me super nervous and uncomfortable anytime he's in the audience at one of my shows, especially when he came to the Idol Worship show. You know, that was like weird. You know, it's like, okay, I'm doing a show with Minx Stoll and he's in the audience, and, you know, like, we're having full on conversations about him. Now, for her, it didn't seem that weird because she'd be telling a story and she'd be like, you know, it's true, John. You know, it. She'd like, you know,
were you surprised he didn't start heckling you? Like, that's not true.
Kind of. I mean, it was sort of amazing. And he said something at the end of that show that was so touching and meaningful to both of us, because he came into the dressing room and we were there, and he was like, well, neither of you need to, you know, feel like you have to speak at my funeral now, because I feel like I just, you know, I just, you know, got to witness firsthand, like, all the lovely things that you might discuss. And that was very special for me. And you guys have a great show on your hands. And thank you.
You got to put that on the poster. John Waters endorsed.
Yeah, we should.
Does it sell more tickets to say that this is not approved by John Waters?
Well, you know, like I say, every show is different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right. I would guess that Mink, you know, maybe she told stories a certain way because he was in the audience. I don't know. We'll find out in Chicago. It was nice to have him in the audience, but also surreal and strange. And I got nervous backstage in a way that I don't, you know, I haven't gotten that nervous in a long time.
My first boyfriend lived in Baltimore, and he worked at a hotel in the restaurant. And he said Divine used to live in the hotel, and she would come down to the restaurant to eat in a woman's bathrobe with, like, little feathers, like what are those called, the Mirabeau feathers, and then little, like, kitten slippers, but, like, his feet were, like, mostly exposed. And then he said he had the dirtiest feet in the world.
He don't like to wear shoes.
So he really was one of America's, you know, the filthiest person alive.
Well, they also, I mean, they were very, like, glamorous and fabulous and exciting and wild and weird, but they were also kind of like just not pretentious and down and dirty. And, like, you know, John Waters famously hitchhikes everywhere. They were all like that, you know. They didn't have airs about their celebrity. They still don't. I mean, they're very, very, in many ways, they're kind of super normal. Like, sometimes I want to, like, shake them and be like, you changed the fucking world. Don't you realize, like they don't walk around, neither of them, John or Minx, in my experience, kind of knowing or being in touch with just how many lives. Like, they think it's weird that people have tattoos of them, you know.
Yeah. One of my Facebook friends was just, like, updated, like, the great thing about being in Baltimore is you get to run into Mink Stoll at Target.
Yeah. Or, like, John. I mean, you know, they're around. You know, someone said something to me the other day. They were like, oh, I saw John Waters the other day pumping gas at a gas station. And I was like, yeah. Do you think someone else does it? You know, it's like that. They're just, you know, normal people.
I love that sentiment, though. When you do things right, people won't be sure you've done anything at all. And in some ways, like, that's the legacy of these extraordinary individuals, and certainly Divine, is that she changed so much of what we think about drag that, you know, in a lot of ways, she gave birth to the modern drag queen. Mimi M. First directed and co-wrote a play called Divine Intervention that ran in Pittsburgh for a while.
Really?
Yeah. Had two different actors playing Glenn Harris Milstead out of drag, Divine out of drag, and Divine. And the love-hate relationship that she struggled with her own drag creation and her own legacy. And I really wish I could have seen it, because it sounds extraordinary.
Yeah, I'm surprised she didn't bring it out to different cities and stuff, because it looked totally interesting, and the concept is so, I think, and I could be wrong, you'll have to ask Mimi, but I'm pretty sure that it's as simple as the play taking place in a dressing room where the one Divine is looking into a mirror at Glenn, you know, and vice versa.
Clever.
Yeah, very clever and very theatrical. And what an amazing story, what an amazing character, you know, a person that, you know, I would love to see something like that. I also think it's really risky and audacious. People say, why don't you do more Divine parodies or do more Divine shows? And it's like, I don't know. For me, it's very hard to kind of touch, or it would make me nervous, that kind of homage.
Isn't everything you do in some ways a parody or a tribute to Divine?
Yes, I think that's a better way to look at it. Honestly, I think you're right. I think you're completely right. So to do a literal reinterpretation of something like Female Trouble is not of interest to me, because it's just so perfect. And I just can't imagine casting someone who could do that. And, you know, I thought the queens on Drag Race, when they had the John Waters challenge, rose to the occasion. But I also felt like, for me, as someone who, like, for me, those movies are kind of like, you know, the way Christians would, you know, look at the Bible or something. You know, I was kind of watching the episode kind of cringing, you know, like, oh God, you know. But I have to say, I thought Ginger Minj, justifiably, like, you know, was fantastic. You know, like, they did a good job. It wasn't like they did a bad job. I just, for me personally, you just don't touch it. You know, it's sacrilege.
Now, have you been watching Drag Race, RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars 3? Because, you know, your friend and somebody you work with a lot, Ben de la Creme, just relinquished her
crown.
Spot.
Oh, yeah.
Her spot on the show.
What?
Yeah.
She did what?
Well, she sent herself home.
No.
Have you not seen
have
this?
Have you not watched this? Come on.
I'm just kidding.
And then they called, they called her Ben de la Christ. And I was just like, oh, well, I guess she is part of Peaches' family now.
She is part of the family. Mm-hmm. She's Ben de la Christ, you know.
Ben de la Christ.
I mean, she is, you know, sacrificing. Yes, of course. And, you know, Ben is here right now and actually could show up any minute now. I'm looking at my partner, who's waiting to see if Ben arrives, because she's coming over. But yeah, she's in town, obviously, because we're doing Drag Becomes Her on Saturday in San Francisco. And then we do it next week in Seattle and Portland, and then next month in Los Angeles. And I'm so excited for this show. More so than a lot of shows. I'm excited for all the shows, but I don't know. I have this feeling about this one in particular that it's going to have long legs, and maybe, you know, we will be able to bring it to Chicago and around. I just feel like it has that momentum behind it.
Sure. Well, it's a great movie. So you start with a great movie. You've got two campy women fighting with each other. You have Isabella Rossellini, equally campy, and then you have this, you know, this stooge husband that doesn't know what to do. So it's such a great little farce.
Well, and the premise is, you know, this anti-aging potion.
Yeah.
And then they push their bodies to the limit.
It's literally a universal monster movie send up, where the monster is celebrity, and it's begging for drag queens to do it. I mean, it feels like Robert Zemeckis, who, as far as I know, is a heterosexual man, really understands camp and queerness. The movie is perfection. It stands the test of time. The performances are completely delicious, and it's a joy. It's a fun thing to get to reenact, you know. And I've done it before, where I played the Madeline character, the Meryl Streep character, and Heclina played Helen, the Goldie Hawn character. So this is a new, you know, it's for Heclina and I to kind of step back and Jinx and Ben de la you know, play the leads. I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm super excited with the way it's coming together. As far as Drag Race goes, I think that was really, you know, really exciting, and it'll be interesting to see how it all, you know, continues to play out. And I do watch the show, of course.
Do you feel like a lot of people criticize Ben de la Creme for sending herself home, saying, you know, she's sort of trying to subvert the rules of the pageant, of the system, and being disrespectful to the show itself?
Well, I mean, okay, so I feel like my take on it, of course, I cannot speak for Ben de la Creme, and will not. She can only speak for herself.
Well, we could just wait until she shows up and you just put her on the phone.
She's not probably going to come up. Like, we literally have to go.
You have to meet her downstairs.
That's fine. Yeah, so my problem is that I have to go pick up the other one from the airport.
Okay.
But she is a dear friend of mine. And, you know, I've been friends with Ben since before she was on Drag Race the first time. You know, I've known her for years. So when people kind of are questioning her sort of motivations or her integrity, or, you know, I actually listened to Vivacious on your show kind of question Ben's character in a way that was, you know, kind of upset me a little bit, because I was thinking like, oh, it's such a shame because I know her, like really truly feel like I know her, and she's not a devious, calculated person, you know, at all.
Like, yeah. It was kind of weird, Vivacious's take on it, wasn't it?
She was really clear that she thinks Ben is devious and, you know, calculated and kind of wicked. Phony.
But Vivacious loves Drag Race, and she feels like she owes so much to that show that in some ways, I think sometimes Vivacious takes the air of caution in taking the side of Drag Race, even when Drag Race does make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. This was before that. Vivacious was saying that about her before she went away.
Because she's not comfortable in saying negative things about people on camera. That's what it boils down to. I don't think Ben is. Yeah. Ben comes from a philosophy, a very sincere philosophy of all artists are valid and everybody deserves to shine.
That is exactly the truth. And it's exactly why she's not totally right for a show that thrives on that kind of drama.
And if Jinx Monsoon had never been on RuPaul's Drag Race and become the winner, I don't know if Ben de la Creme would ever been on the show herself, because it was really Jinx that dragged Ben onto that series.
I guess. I mean, I think they both, if they audition, like, they both are wildly, brilliantly talented. They have more talent in their pinky than, you know, most drag queens will ever have. And I know that sounds obnoxious of me to say, but I've worked with so many drag queens, and those two are just extremely naturally talented. They're also both extremely sensitive.
And they can memorize their lines.
They can memorize their lines. They can write. They can create. They can make music. They can, you know, do lyrics. They can write shows. They can do so much. And they're both really into performing and being entertainers. But they're also very, very sensitive, and they grew up in a very loving and protective and nurturing drag community. Mm-hmm. Honestly, you know, that's what the Seattle scene is. It's very, very supportive and sweet and kind. And so I can just say to the listeners who want to believe me that Ben de la Creme is not a devious or calculated person. She's just not.
Do you think that when they have the reunion and they crown somebody, do you think Ben is still in the running? Do you think RuPaul might be just like, hey, you know what? You gave it, but like sometimes, you know, I respect that, and here's the crown anyway.
I mean, my two senses just from, you know, knowing nothing about what might be coming down the road is that that's probably not going to happen, you know. But, you know, you never know. I mean, I honestly don't know. I don't have some inside scoop. I don't think anyone knows who wins. You know, so, well,
On a similar topic, do you think it's a bad idea to comment on future castings of your own reality TV show series as RuPaul keeps doing over and over again? And I wish
over whether people should have titties or not,
or who gets to be on RuPaul's Drag Race. And you said this before here on the show, and I want you to bring this up again. You said before that it's impossible for that show to represent all of drag.
Yes, I stand by that. I think it's impossible for us to look to any one show and it's clearly RuPaul's show, and it always has been, to embody or showcase all of what drag can be. Drag is so much bigger than one TV show. And that's why, personally, lately, I've found Drag Race super fans to be annoying. Like,
yeah, you and Bob.
Well, and everybody's like,
have you seen his Twitter fights with these people? Yeah. Like,
yes, just because I have.
I know you're excited to see a celebrity, but trust me, a celebrity is not excited to see you.
Okay, now
and I'm like, I love the truth bomb. I love it.
Yeah.
My thing is, I said to someone this morning about that because they sent me Bob's thread, and I said, I don't know why she would put herself in this position because she's not going to change their minds. And for the most part, most fans are wonderful. I'm a fan. I'm a huge fan of that show and of DragCon and of what it's done for drag. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But when these fans turn mean and crazy, like where there's death threats involved, and I get it. That's a select few, but that I have no time for. And it's such a turnoff, and it really ruins it for everyone. It ruins mm-hmm. the fun of it. And when you take a TV show that seriously, and there have been things people I know, like people I actually know who have written things that I'm like, what? You are giving that show way too much power in your mind to have that kind of a feeling or reaction about it. And I'm not talking about what Rue said as far as, you know, casting goes. I'm speaking more specifically mm-hmm. about reacting to what happens on the TV show itself. You know, the way they respond to the way the girls are on the show. I just don't get investing that much emotional energy into something that's clearly edited, clearly created for entertainment. And, you know, it's not real life. It's fantasy. And some of the reactions where people write horrible things, threatening things, I think we all need to kind of shut it down together. Like, no.
Well, and that's no even when that happens in our own community. And if you're running a forum or you're running a theater show, excuse me, if you're running a forum or a theater show or any kind of artist collective or fan collective, it's really important to address that toxic culture when it arises, because otherwise it destroys your own community.
And at some point, I'm kind of hoping maybe that the show itself or that the convention itself does something to address it. I think it's there. We should look at it. And I think the leaders are going to soon have an obligation to say that there is no room for this in this community. It's not been part of this community, and it certainly shouldn't be in the future. You know, making death threats, using racist language, being nasty that way. No, we've no time for that. You know, shut it down.
They certainly have their work cut out for them. And RuPaul's Drag Race Season 10, Season of the X, premieres March 22nd on VH1 and on the iTunes Store app.
Mm. And I'm sure you've covered this, but you did cover the fact that whether, you know, it's enough or not, Rue did put out a sort of a statement acknowledging that she... you know, was learning and evolving and had, it seemed like an apology, you know, for hurting.
You know, I think RuPaul's never worked a job as a restaurant waiter or in customer service, because that's the first thing you learn when you're dealing with angry customers is to just acknowledge their distress.
I'm sure she has worked in the service industry growing up. I don't think so. You know, I mean,
or maybe she's forgotten what that's like, but it's like when you face with an angry customer, the first thing you don't do is say, shut up, stupid. You know,
but the thing that I feel like she is in the unique position of being in is, and I think this way about a lot of celebrities I've grown up worshiping. Like, you know, I've talked about it before. I fucking love Oprah Winfrey, and I grew up watching her, and, you know, I love Oprah.
I didn't know that.
Yes, I'm a huge Oprah fan. Always have been. Grew up watching her in local news in Baltimore. She moved to Chicago. She had her talk show. All the Maryland community watched her talk show. I watched it all the time. Love The Color Purple. Just love, love, love Oprah. What made her lovable to me was that she was this relatable woman who connected, you know, and was a unifier. as she became more and more famous and more successful, she kind of left the planet, right? And now she lives on Planet Oprah. And I feel like Madonna is the same way. Like, these people that we love and admire who grow up in the trenches, not fucking Donald Trump, not someone who was born with a silver spoon in their mouth, but someone that really lived the American dream and made it, you know, from the bottom up, like Oprah, Madonna, and RuPaul. They sometimes reach this level of success and fame where they do kind of fall out of touch with all the folks that were there, you know, at the beginning, and all that kind of connective stuff, that unifying tissue. I think it's harder to stay in touch with people when you are living on your own planet. I don't know if I'm describing it the right way.
I remember meeting RuPaul when she was promoting Star Booty and seeing her sitting in drag at a meet and greet after the film, and few people showed up. Nobody wanted to meet her.
She was like, behind a velvet rope, just sitting on a stool.
Just sitting there.
Five or six people came over to say hi.
And people were just like, oh, RuPaul's such a has-been. How tragic, all this stuff. And Mark and I were like, oh my God, we're hanging out with RuPaul. RuPaul, let's go do shots, you know. Let's go stay out all night.
You were more interested in hitting on Mike Ruiz, if I remember correctly, and his big
well, he was
muscles.
Very handsome too.
Yes, he was very handsome.
But it was a great opportunity to sort of get behind the scenes and understand what this legendary person was. And we're lucky that we still have RuPaul. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like RuPaul had a health scare in the season, the third season of RuPaul's Drag Race, that they had to take some time off. You know, and it's like, to me, I'm always like very grateful that we still have Drag Race mm-hmm. and RuPaul mm-hmm. to love and to scorn mm-hmm. and to wish she mm-hmm. was wiser.
The weird thing about
The
weird thing about her apology on Twitter is, like, she posted this, like, green and yellow flag, and somebody pointed out, and it may be incorrectly, but they pointed out, they're like, that, like, are you using this to represent the trans flag? Did you Google trans flag, but actually you wrote trains, because that's the color of, like, the train flag or something like that? It was
Really? Weird,
yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
It was a weird thing, but then somebody else pointed out, no, it's from this book that she'd probably been reading about this guy who says, you know, when you look at the color when you're on a train and you look at the color of the forest, it kind of like looks this one color, but when you slow down and really look at it, you see all the different colors.
She's referencing a painter, pop culture artist, Ellsworth Kelly, mm-hmm. whose famous painting Train Landscape mm-hmm. is a blurring of green, lime chartreuse, and yellow. And the idea that when you're looking outside of a window of a train, all you see are these fields of green.
I mean, I feel like there's hope in her statement, and you know, it is a surreal and negative thing, because from my point of view, and I can only imagine that it's Rue's experience as well, but like growing up in the drag world of San Francisco, we've always, in a way that was not questioned, had cis and trans women be part of our world and mm-hmm. in drag in a way that mm-hmm. was just not any different from the cis men that were doing drag. You know, like mm-hmm. it was always about who, if you look at the casts for any of my shows, even to this day, there will be cis women on stage, trans women on stage, cis men, and everything in between, mm-hmm. non-binary people. And so it's just strange to me that it went in that direction mm-hmm. and it seemed a bit short-sighted mm-hmm. and weird, but
it reminded me of many, many, many years ago on the podcast, probably around 2007, 2008 or something. We had a episode called, I think it was called Drag Wars, because one of the local drag queens who was performing Regina Upright was upset because, you know, there was a club in town, like a lot of the trans girls were getting jobs, and she felt like that the boy drag queens weren't getting because they were able to pop their titties out. And so people were wanting to see that kind of thing. And so she was really trying to like raise a big stink about this kind of thing. And Faust was just like, you know, if people aren't interested in your act, change up your act a little bit. And that was the last thing she wanted to hear from us.
But it's true. Yeah. It's so true. And it's like, you know, I don't know. It seems like so unfortunate because, like mm-hmm. I said before, and we've talked about, while that show cannot represent all of drag, no one can deny the importance that RuPaul's Drag Race has had on drag culture. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, it's the only drag culture they have, like it or not. And so I hope they do open their minds to not giving a shit about whether people are trans or even, you know, cis women. But that's just the drag world that I come from. It's always been normal.
The other thing, though, too, is like, you know, could this be violations of some kind of labor laws? Because, you know, you hire these people to perform on your reality TV show. And if you're discriminating against them based on their sex or gender or, you know,
because the state of California does have gender identity discrimination.
So sadly, though, I do think there's caveats when it comes to casting. So there is a you know, you are allowed to cast for specific types. And I think so that's an interesting question. And if that's true, then, you know, then why aren't cis women on the show? Or, you know, what, you know, basically, right. Like, so yeah, but I do think that there is a caveat for casting in Hollywood or casting shows, or, you know, probably would be different if their crew were all men, you know, or something like that, or all white people.
Peaches Christ, two words, inclusion rider.
No,
if
true.
Lady Gaga knew about that inclusion rider, she would have forced World of Wonder to cast transgender, post-operational transgender women and drag kings and all this stuff. And you know, moving forward, Frances McDormand's iconic Oscar speech is going to have repercussions, including on RuPaul's Drag Race, because if they want to keep getting those A-list celebrity judges, they're going to have inclusion writers, and those inclusion writers are going to cause up a stir. We'll see.
It'll be interesting. You guys, unfortunately, I think I might have to run because it's getting down to the wire for me.
Thank you, darling.
But no, I'm so, you know me. I think I probably clock in at your fucking longest shows in the history of Feast of Fun because I like to chat a long time.
One quick thing I wanted to just see. What's the word on Divine's statue that's being built in Baltimore?
You know, I don't know. That was like an internet thing for a long, long time. And I haven't heard or seen anything more about it. But I will say this, that there's an incredible, if you ever go to Baltimore, there is an incredible museum there of outsider art that is amazing. And it features, and it's beautiful, and it's big, and it's a proper museum. And most outsider art museums don't get the kind of prestige that this does. And inside, Andrew Logan, an artist from England, who used to host the Miss Alternative, the Alternative Miss World pageant, which was the basically giant, big alt drag pageant in England since the 70s. Divine used to host it. Andrew Logan has created a giant sculpture statue of Divine that is in that museum in Baltimore, and I would encourage everyone to go see it and explore the rest of the museum. Yeah, of course.
Peaches, thank you so much for sharing your stories, and we're looking so much forward to having you in Chicago. And if you have a little extra time, maybe you can fry up something delicious with us on Cooking with Drag Queens.
Well, I mean, I don't know how secretive you need to be, but I'll tell you this. If that doesn't happen and I'm not on that goddamn cooking show, there won't be another cooking show, because Mark and Fausto will be shot dead for the sake of art.
Oh, oh my God. Who wants to die for art? We all do.
Yeah, me, I do.
Thank you, Peaches. Break a leg. And
thank
give,
you, guys.
Ben and Jinx are best, and Heclino.
I will. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, darling.
Bye. Do you really have to say nice things about Heclina?
Peaches Christ lives in San Francisco.
You get your tickets. She's coming to Chicago April the 18th at Hamburger Mary's, peacheschrist.com. If you don't get, really stop right now.
Just whatever you're doing, go get that ticket now, because you're going to regret not getting to see that. Because
that's
show.
One of those things, you know, when we saw Coco Peru's show recently, she pointed out to, you know, she came to a town, she did her show, and then somebody was just like, oh, you know, this, one of her fans was like, oh, I didn't see your show, but I'll see it next time. And Coco's like, next time? Next time? Who knows if there's going to be a next time? You know, Mink's 70-some years old. There might not be a next time. Don't think like, oh, I'll see it. Idol Worship will be back next month. I'll see it next month.
Yeah, they're not like a movie or a television show. You know, you just catch it on reruns or something. This is a live experience. Mm-hmm. You get to be in a small group of people. The VIP tickets are not that expensive either, like to meet Mink Stole and have your photo taken with her and tell her what her and John Waters and Divine and Peaches Christ mean to you. To get to have your photo taken with these extraordinary, legendary artists is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If you don't treat yourself, you're going to cheat yourself. So go get that ticket now. PeachesChrist.com.
I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support, so if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen.
And we want to thank everybody for supporting Cooking with Drag Queens and Feast of Fun. If you want to help us make more episodes, go to feastoffun.com/donate and make a one-time donation. And if you are a Feast of Fun Plus member, you get to see all our behind-the-scenes footage and special bonus recipes and all sorts of goodies that we're posting once Cooking with Drag Queens goes into full season. So we're almost done shooting the first half. And we have some extraordinary artists lined up for that. And we want to thank you guys so much for listening. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
We'll see you at Hamburger Mary's on April the 18th.
And Mary's Addict.
Bye-bye. Bye.